up or the other way around. So they're going to cover like a lot of little things that you may not have ever picked up on. And if you've never opened a lock without a key before, you're going to learn a whole lot more. So now we have all kinds of audio and video. And this one's already working. Good. Are we good?
Yeah, we're good. We're
all
great.
Right.
All right.
Finally.
Who's ready to have fun? So I'm going to start by introducing myself.
You want to introduce yourselves, or you can probably pronounce your own names better than me.
Lockpicking
a primer.
So this is a three-hour panel/intro. We will be taking a break at about an hour and a half. It's a little bit different than what the schedule says, but bear with us. This format is going to allow us to cover quite a bit of material in a short period of time and really engage a lot of you, so I think it's going to be fun. My name is Doug Farr. I'm president of LockSport International. We are similar to the group Tool, which many members are sitting up here with me. We are around almost as long as they have been. We kind of do the same stuff that they do, but we'll touch on more of that later. So
you just look damn sexy. You're doing it, don't you?
Oh, thank you. That's how I've been getting our membership base up. Never mind.
Jagor.
Hi, I'm Jagor. I run the Longhorn Lockpicking Club in Austin, Texas. We were founded in fall 2006, so coming up on 8 years now. I think we were one of the first, if not the first, LockSport International major chapters, sort of the flagship chapter, and now we're sort of autonomous. We kind of run our own group now. We operate out of the University of Texas at Austin.
I'm Jos Weijers. I'm from the Netherlands. I'm a member of Tool NL. That's the original Tool. Starting of this year, I'm the vice president of that group.
Ray?
I'm Ray. I'm from the Sportsfreunde der Sperrtechnik. It's German's LockSport group. I think the oldest LockSport group in the world, founded 1997. And doing lockpicking for.
Say that name one more time.
Sportsfreunde der Sperrtechnik.
Yeah, it means sports friends of lockpicking, basically, in English.
There we go. I'm Babak Javadi. I'm with the Open Organization of Lockpickers in the U.S. I was one of the co-founding board members for the current form of the organization that started back in 2006. Although we've had a number of additions and departures since then. Deviant, you want to?
Sure. I'm Deviant. You may have seen me around. I'm also on the board of Tool. And I just kind of love talking about this. I love that every hope for a long time, it's been one of the first places that a lot of people saw lockpicking in the U.S. And consistently every time after that, they've had really good lockpicking talks. I think most of the people on this stage right now have been up here before in one form or another. But I don't think we've ever done this before where we kind of, we told them, we said, hey, if you want a lockpick thing, we could do that. But like, isn't intro like kind of old and busted? And they're like, no, everyone wants to learn. We're like, all right, we'll do an intro. But what if we mixed it in with other cultural lock sport topics and we took a lot more time for Q&A? And I think that's going to be really rewarding for at least us, hopefully you too. So, we're going to kind of kick it off here and go with, we're going to see how this rolls.
I think before we begin, I think I wanted to recognize something interesting that I just remembered and realized here. So,
what's that?
Modern lock sport as it exists in the United States today was kind of born here at Hope. I don't know if everyone has realized that before, the first Tool chapter before Tool was a big organization in the U.S. was started by a group of people in northern New Jersey, Eric Michaud and Mouse and a couple of others from the Princeton group. And they had been meeting, for some time before 2006. But in 2006, at Hope, actually, was when the current form of Tool in the U.S. was actually formally started. That was when we created the first board of directors for Tool. And so this is a really special experience for a lot of us because this is kind of where it all started for us. This is where it started for me. Hope was my first hacker conference. It was the first time that we started Tool formally, and it's really a pleasure and an honor to be back here again now here in 2014 talking about where we are today.
That's actually an interesting question because, as well, H2K was my first real HackerCon. Can we get a show of hands? How many people is this like your first experience with a HackerCon? Or was Hope your first one ever? Any of the Hopes? Wow, that's like half the room. That's awesome. So, yeah.
On that note, how many newcomers do we have here? Show of hands, please.
That's a lot of hands.
Good amount. That's a good amount.
It's a really cool mix. Awesome. As long as we... What is Jason Scott's? As long as we can always have the 4-star lobby and the 1-star rooms, we'll keep coming back to the Hotel Penn. So let's kind of groove through this, right? There's this intro that we like to do at some of our events, and it captures the reason people are really fascinated by locks. Even if you're not a lock picker, a lot of people love locks. They love old locks especially. People have lock collections. Some people even just have collections of keys. So locks as a device resonate with us culturally and hold a real special place in a lot of people's hearts. And people have a hard time explaining. If you ask them, you say, why do you like this thing? You don't collect antiques. And they go, I don't know, I really like this like little, I'm going to make it into a little decoration or a token of jewelry. So locks and lock picking, it's not just about subverting security, although that's what a lot of us do professionally in other careers. Like, something just about locks is very fundamental to how we see ourselves, to how we see our culture, to how we see privacy and space. And all of this was captured pretty well in a story that a friend of ours, Skylar, used to tell. He probably still tells it if you ever see him talk. He's a very fun presenter. And Skylar says, I want you to imagine a situation where you're going to meet someone and you're supposed to be there, right? This could either be, let's say you're going to get a new place to live. You're going to go see someone's new apartment that's for rent. Or maybe you're a student. You're going to go see a professor during office hours, or you're going to just go visit friends. Like, yeah, come on over after work. I'll be there at 5:30. So you go to meet somebody, and you're supposed to be there, and it's their space. But what do you encounter? You encounter a door. And if the door is open, right, like the door is just hanging open, most of you would probably not have a real problem walking through it, at least sticking yourself a little, like you stick your head in. You're like, hey, are you here? You know, I'm here. I got here. Because, again, it's an open door. So it signifies something, but it doesn't signify as much of a barrier to us culturally. Now, what if that door is shut? I bet you'd behave a little differently. Now, again, we talked about this. This is either the unoccupied apartment or the professor who's supposed to be in his or her office. So you probably would knock first. I mean, culturally, that's what we learned to do as little kids. You might knock. But if it's like a door that has no lock on it, it's just, you might kind of open it. You might do that thing again where you, hey, are you out here? You know. What if the door were shut, however, and there was a lock? What would you do then? You know, it starts immediately. You're feeling something different about that door. Whether or not it's even locked. Whether or not, you know, just because there's a lock in that door, the door means something different to you. You might take your phone out. You might, before you like try to go, you might, hey, are you here? Like, I got here before you, you know? Because just because that lock is there, it means something. And even if, let's say it's that apartment rental, the landlord's like, oh yeah, I'm in traffic, but there's a little rock under a garden gnome. You can get the key and go in. Some of you might do that, and some of you might be like, oh, I'll wait for you. Because again, the lock represents something to us about space and privacy and demarking our lives. And then the really neat concluding example is, what if the door were open, but it has a lock? Now, at this point, I mean, it doesn't really matter what you personally would do, whether you'd step in or stay out or call somebody or knock or shout. I bet you that door, even though it's literally hanging open, it means something different to you than this door did that didn't have a lock in it at all. And that's part of what locks do to us, and that's part of how we like to think of them. And they're fascinating devices. We treat them as puzzles in lock sport. They're not something to be seen as just this barrier of space. They're something to be explored. As, you know, that's kind of with the hacker ethos, right? I mean, some things demark and barrier out, and we see them as things to be tinkered with. So we love to run games. We love to run contests. We have whole conferences based around this. If you get to learn lock picking, we encourage you to try your hand at any of the games. We have some here. We have some other events. a friend of ours, Shane, who really regrets he couldn't make it. He always loves Hope, but, you know, this is him winning, like, a ninja badge at DEF CON. So try your hand at contests. Some of them are fun. Some of them get really serious. We'll talk a little bit later about the competitive world of lock sport and what you see coming, people from around the world coming, the best people head-to-head. But that's what we're about. That's what lock sport is. It's a fun, entertaining, and hobbyist, unprofessional perhaps, non-professional way to interact with these devices that mean so very much to all of us. And if you've never picked a lock before, I think Doug and some of his people are going to get into that. That's an empty cup, sir. I got to fix you up.
Yes, please. I just want to point out that our community is mostly all-inclusive. And this is mostly about community. So, you know, whether it be security organizations or clubs in your area, or lockpicking or hardware hacking, ultimately you're part of a community, and we're trying to make that community as easy and open to as many members as possible. People ask us not from this crowd, but people have asked us, you know, what differentiates you from a criminal? What differentiates you from someone that's going to break into my house that poses a threat to me? So think about that question. I'm going to answer it later, but there's quite a few differences. So I'm going to come stand on the podium. Just
sure.
Can
you
it's
see
a little
the notes
easier.
And everything?
Yeah.
Okay. All
right. So. Test. Intro to lockpicking. Let's start. First thing, most important part, is we do have rules, and the rules add legitimacy to our organizations and protect our members from getting into places that they shouldn't be and situations that they shouldn't be. So the first rule is do not pick locks which you do not own. That means your dorm room. You do not own that lock. Someone else owns that lock. That includes your apartment complex. I can't stress this enough. Locks are mechanical, they're prone to failure, and if you break a lock that you rely on especially, or which you do not own, there could be a price to pay in terms of damaged property. And along with that, do not pick locks upon which you rely. So your house lock, your car lock, padlocks that are in use. Again, mechanical devices that will break down and fail, especially when you're sticking foreign tools into a space meant for a specific shape and size. Insert your sexual innuendo there. Lockpicking is easy. If you come up to the village, I promise you, we will have you opening locks within the hour. There are some things that we're going to cover that are going to make it more easy, but again, there should be a very low barrier to entry here. And that's something that we pride ourselves on. We allow people that are interested in the security community to come into conferences and spaces like these and participate in a way that they wouldn't be able to if they didn't have the experience in the computer security realm. So it's a great way to get your foot in the door. Pin tumbler locks are the majority of the locks that we're dealing with. They've been around for about a century. We're talking about 90% of the locks that you see on a daily basis. So all the locks pictured here, young and old, are pin tumbler locks. And we're going to go over the mechanism of action pin tumbler locks. So some quick verbiage here. The lock itself, or the lock housing, it can also be called the cylinder, is the whole object on the screen. The plug is the yellow piece. We have the keyway in which the key fits into the wards that prevent only specific types of keys from entering the lock. We have the key pin, which is, we'll talk more about later, but that's that red pin. If you look into the face of a lock, into the opening of a lock, you'll see a key pin is the first pin there. So if I were to take a cross section, cut off the front of the lock, what I would see is, again, our plug, our key pin is our red pin, it makes contact with the key. Our blue pin is our driver pin. So you might ask, you know, why don't we call these bottom and top pins? And that's because in other countries, specifically in the European region, the lock is actually mounted in the 180 degrees. So in that regard, we call them key and driver pins. The entire stack is called the pin stack. If I were to attempt to open the lock with a, for instance, a tension wrench or a screwdriver, what would happen is I would have binding. I would have binding at the driver pin here. The point in which the plug meets the lock housing right here is called the shear line. So I would say the shear line is not free to move and the lock is unopenable or locked. Put the correct key in, the pin raises to the shear line, the driver pin sits above the shear line and the lock opens. Pretty standard. So most locks have several pin stacks. In this particular picture, we have 5 pin stacks. That's most of the residential housing in the U.S. has a lock, a quick set, a Schlage, a cylinder that's very low security. It has 5 pin stacks in general. So we have locks with, you know, as little as 3 and as many as 8. Different levels of complexity, obviously. So insert the correct key, all the key pins raise to the correct height, the driver pin sit above the shear line, the lock can open. The cuts on the keys themselves are called the bitting. When the correct bit is cut into the key, obviously we have the shear line here. In the second position on the key, the driver pin is now sitting below the shear line because while every single pin stack is correctly at the correct position, the second one is not. This is an example of that specific bit cut too high. Again, we're binding now at the key pin instead of the driver pin. In a perfect world, if we had very, very precise manufacturing processes, and the reason why we can pick and manipulate locks open with tools that, you know, may or may not resemble a key is due to the manufacturing deficiencies in the manufacturing process. So, you know, while the assembly line is fairly accurate, the for instance, the drill bit used to jig the hole might be a little dull on this run and a little less dull on this run. So in a perfect world, if I were to draw a line down the center of the plug here, this is the plug removed from the lock, the yellow piece here, and now we're looking down onto it. What I would see in a perfect world was there would be no difference in if I were to draw a line down the center, all of the holes would align perfectly with that imaginary line that I just drew. Now, in the real world, we can see a close up this lock. This plug was taken out of a lock that was in very short use, but you can see very close up, there's material missing from some of the routed holes there. And they all have slightly different characteristics. So again, this is what allows us to manipulate locks open. If we look at the pins themselves, you can see there's some issues here with this pin, material missing there. So we're dealing with a material that's very soft in general. Brass is what a lot of locks are made out of. It's not the only material, but brass in particular is soft and can deform over time and can deform through heat and obviously during the manufacturing process. So again, all of these characteristics add to our ability to manipulate locks. So if in this example, I draw a line down the center of the plug there, what I would see is maybe the second pin stack or that is the fourth pin stack, the hole here has a delta between that imaginary line, the most. There's a largest delta between the center and the and that hole. So what happens is the plug will while it's turning will bind at a specific pin, and usually it's only a single pin. So what happens is we put our pick in, we feel around into the lock, we find the specific pin stack that is the most difficult to move, that has the most pressure, that has the most binding pressure from the lock, make more sense in a bit, and we move that particular pin up to the point where it picks, and we move on to the next one. So for instance, if I had a tension wrench inside the lock, I'm applying tension, and I move that specific pin that's binding up, what you'll see is the lock will turn maybe a little bit, maybe a tenth of a degree, something very minute but noticeable, and then we'll move on to the next pin. So that process in general, kind of the essence of lock picking is being able to identify the binding pin. picking the binding pin and then knowing that you've picked the binding pin. And this may be something that you can actually use all of your senses for. You can use sight. You may hear a clicking. Like I said, you might see, you know, the lock rotate a tenth of a degree. So that's really the essence of the lock picking process. And, you know, obviously there's quite a bit more to learn, but with this basic knowledge set, you should be able to open, you know, most locks that you see on a daily basis. And that's not an understatement. So
do we want to put our money where our mouth is and like switch?
Absolutely, yeah. We'll stop listening to me talk for a minute. Let's get some demonstrations here.
By all means. So we'll have Babak and I. You've got a microphone. You can talk this through a little better here.
All right. So while Dave here tries to pick this lock, you'll notice that we've got a couple tools here. These are all tools from our current pick set that we have down the Lockpick Village, but open. Already open. All right. So I can just stop talking, I guess. No, you're going to keep going? Okay, good. So what's the most important thing with lockpicking, as many of you probably already know, is to find the right tensioner, to find the right turning tool. What you really want is a turning tool that really bites into the keyway. So for example...
Open!
Yeah, you got a cock and balls.
Open! No one noticed that you picked the lock.
So what you want is you want the thickest turning tool that actually fits in the keyway, so the less slop there is, the better feedback you get from the lock cylinder. And what that allows you to do, what Dave is doing here, is as he's applying very light turning pressure to the plug, he's able to feel, both in the turning tool and in the pick tool, how those pins inside the lock are behaving. So you can feel when a pin is dragging more. You can feel the grittiness of the pin. You can feel the grinding. You can feel when there's more tension or pressure against certain other pins.
Yeah, you'll see in a minute on the slides as Doug keeps talking what I'm representing here. Just really light pressure. This bad. No.
So a very common question is, well, that's great. Light pressure. What the hell does that mean? Can you quantify that? Can you give me anything actionable, anything useful? Imagine pressing a key on a modern laptop keyboard, on a membrane keyboard. You don't require a lot of pressure to actually depress that key. That's about as much pressure you're going to be using when picking a lock, which is not very intuitive. If you apply more, what happens is the pins begin binding up more than they otherwise would, and it'll be very difficult to overcome that friction. So if you apply too much pressure, it's very difficult to pick the lock. And if you don't apply enough pressure, then you have a situation where you can't feel the binding pins. So very, very light pressure is really the key here.
Doug, tell them about what happens if they push too far.
If you push too far?
Thank you.
Hilarious. If you apply too much tension, what's going to happen is you're going to overset a pin. In this particular slide, what you're going to see is the key pin going up too high, basically going up into the cylinder or into this part of the lock, which is called the Bible. Let's wait for that animation. There we go. And it's going to get stuck, and that's oversetting or overlifting a pin in the pin stack. It may be hard to realize that you're doing that at first. Like, you know, obviously you're not going to be looking at the side of the lock when you're picking it. I think it was Josh Nekreb from Lockpicking 101 said once, lockpicking is like solving puzzles in the dark. So there's a lot of visual representation going on. It's not a sight-full-based activity. So if that does happen, what we're going to do is we're going to release tension on the lock, we're going to reset the lock, and then we're going to start over. I like to tell beginners in particular, if you haven't picked the lock within 20, 30, 40 seconds, you should probably reset the lock and start over.
If it's an easier lock. I mean, not every lock is going to open in 20, 30, 40 seconds.
For beginners. For me, at least.
This is why I love the idea of this panel.
I can open
our whole
it in
deal
seconds.
Was like sniping at each other on shit we disagree on. Just like some of us are just every time you say the word tension, I'm like dying.
Oh.
Those of us who are sticklers, you know, tension is attractive force, and like it's turning
torque.
Pressure, turning
torque.
Tool.
Okay, yeah. We'll use Tor from now on to make DB happy.
Even that sounds too bad.
But for you guys that want to come on down to Lockpick Village later and try, don't use that 30-second benchmark as a, oh no, I can't open it in 30 seconds. Yeah. I'm terrible.
Well, if our staff doesn't open the lock in 30 seconds, you can throw those little black rockets at us.
Well, there's other things you can blame on the lock if it's not opening in 30 seconds. So you'll learn to do that as well.
Sage advice: if it doesn't open in 30 seconds, blame the lock.
What was the name of the book?
That's how
we made
it this far.
Oh yeah, Tobias's book was open in 30 seconds. So that's the standard, right?
Anyways,
what other tools we got?
Other tools. Let's keep going. So there's another method of opening locks called the raking method. Not something we generally teach, but it is kind of a brute force method of opening a lock and more of a random. Method.
Technique. It's not all random.
Yeah, I teach this all the time. It's way easier.
I don't teach it. You want to learn how to pick locks, you're going to do it the right way or you're not going to do it at all.
So, yeah, as you can see, well, the reason there's the controversy here, so rake tools are usually, their working head is longer and they touch multiple pin stacks simultaneously. That's kind of a feature of raking. So it doesn't lend itself to a deliberate finesse process of I'm touching this pin, what do I feel under this pin? It's literally just scrub, 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 and open. And for all of the freaking nerdy people in the room, someone who saw it once, they saw lifting, and it's, we're picking, it took a while, and then they saw raking, and they were like, we're blowing through everything. Like, I was raking some of those earlier. And they're like, oh, so raking is more powerful. And I said, no, not more powerful, just more seductive. So it is.
Raping.
Yeah.
Raping.
No.
That's what it looks like.
My analogy is
not good.
A rake is, it's basically like an automatic transmission. And a lifting pick, a hooking pick, it's like a stick shift. This is another good show of hands question for this room, because it's not like your usual crowd of people in this country anymore. How many people can drive a stick shift in this room? There you go. So if you learned to drive a car and you learned on a stick shift. We got the camera? Oh, well. If you learned on a stick shift, you can always get behind the wheel of an automatic if, your buddy's drunk at a party and you got to drive it home. But if you learned on an automatic and then you get behind the wheel of someone's car and you're like, why are there three pedals? It kind of screws you up. So we encourage, as Doug would say, we encourage people to try the finesse technique and to learn good pick discipline first with lifting. Then, like Bobak and I, we own a pen testing company. How many times do we start with raking?
All of the times.
Because I want to get in the door before the guard comes around the corner.
Right. And so if
same
you,
with competition, everybody will start off.
Of course,
race.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even in our championships at LockCon and at other events, everyone starts with raking. A couple swipes with raking first.
He's shaking his head.
The thing is, though, if you waste your time raking...
I'm going to talk over Doug right now. Jagor, tell me, how far did raking get me in the competition at LockCon last year?
So, last year you did pretty good.
I did pretty good.
Sixth in the world, I think.
In our competition. Obviously, not everyone in the world would come to our competition.
That gets an applause right there, honestly.
We did. So, the reason I bring that up is because will raking get you into every lock? No. But if you understand enough about how locks work and how they respond, you can learn how to use a brute force technique and add your own kind of finesse into it. So you can learn very quickly if a lock is going to respond to raking or not. And so it looks very random. If you look at someone who is not very experienced and someone who is very experienced and you look at what they're doing when they're raking, it looks identical. But for the person who's actually doing the picking, it feels very different. I can tell, and after the competition, Jagor actually asked me, he's like, Bobak, what the fuck? Raking, I've always just thought is silly. How is it that, what are you doing? How is it that it's working? And for me, I can say that whenever I'm raking a lock, I can actually feel the lock it feels different. It begins to respond differently, and I can tell that I'm getting somewhere. And that's something that you gain with experience. So if you just start learning with only raking, then, you're not necessarily learning a whole lot about how the lock is going to respond. But if you combine the techniques, you can become very, very proficient at opening locks quickly.
I don't know what's up with the camera, but oh well.
No, it's two cycles.
Oh, it's two. Oh, yeah, see, there we go.
You got to turn it off and on again.
Yeah. Hello, IT.
Good luck.
You want to try to break that one?
Yeah. So we'll try this blue master lock here really quick.
While you guys are attempting to scrub the lock open, let me ask Jagor another question. When you won first place at DEF CON and had an all-inclusive paid trip to the Netherlands to compete, what was your method of opening the lock?
So historically, I've been sort of a purist. You can rake a lock open, but I consider it a dishonorable victory. So my pick set is just full of short hooks here. I focus almost exclusively on single pin picking, so that's what I did for the U.S. Championship.
And we're proud of you for it.
I think the real point there was that if you get good enough, you get your trips paid for to come compete in the Netherlands.
Yeah. Well, like, who wants a free trip to Amsterdam and then a train ride to Snake? Get good at picking.
Especially the train ride to Snake.
Yeah. All right. So, halftime.
What was that?
Half diamonds and stuff.
It's been an hour and a half?
No.
Halftime?
Half diamonds.
Half diamonds, sorry. Yeah, yeah. I'm saying halftime. I'm like, this isn't the Super Bowl. Not like we'd be watching it anyways.
It's better.
So, several different tools. We've talked about these already, but let's just put them into context. This is our short hook or our what do you call the short hook?
Short hook.
A hook.
Feeler hook.
A what?
Just a hook.
A hook? Okay.
In between the long hook and the gonzo.
Or feeler. That's what I was getting at. Feeler.
Sure. Hook, feeler. Everyone feeler, has different names pick. For them. It's whatever.
We're getting as sensual
as we
can here.
I gave a whole talk just about pick terminology at DerbyCon, and if you speak Spanish, I gave a talk at Echo Party. The videos are online. There's like a billion terms for all the picks that are out there, and half of them are describing the same pick.
All right. So anyways, you'll hear many different terms for the same stuff, and don't let it overwhelm you. Again, oops, this is obviously the hook-like pick, so that's all you need to remember. We have the half diamond. Notable characteristic of the half diamond is it's a straight pick all the way from the base of the pick to the end of the pick, and that we'll talk about why that's important later. And then we have our rake, and again, like Deviant said, there's about a million different types of rake styles, but anything that doesn't look like these two, you can just call a rake. There are some ridiculous names, double, triple snowman. I don't even, anyone have any good names?
King and queen picks.
King and queen picks, okay. So anyone can come up with a pick design and, you know, name it something ridiculous.
So we're going to show you some different rakes here.
Nobody with a C or snake.
So, for example, here's, you know...
Stuff you should throw away.
Why don't you go through the names here?
So, yeah, I mean, the classic triple hump or Fogota, because it's not quite a Bogota like this one. You have the dual hump Savannah, P-knuckle, another P-knuckle. It's interesting that all of us have moved to the really severe raking profile compared with, like, this is, you know, the long jag, the L-rake, or the old-fashioned, like the one on the slides that you saw earlier, the sort of just the C-rake or S-rake or snake or, yeah, here we got one here. So that was, you know, how many people, show your hands, if you have a pick kit that ever had this pick in it. Like, it came with every pick set, along with that stupid single ball. But now, like, almost all the rake profiles have moved to this Raimundo-style, very severe humped tool that originally started out with his Bogota set and has been knocked off and copied any number of times over.
Can someone tell me what that those severe or... very deep cuts. What that resembles?
You're asking them or us?
I don't mean.
Are you talking about this?
Anyone
picture?
Who understands what I'm talking
You're not
about,
boobs as a
please
joke
answer.
Right?
No, it no. resembles a bump key, right?
Yeah, kind of.
We have very deep cuts. So, just a note.
But yeah, I mean, just all of those and more. There's tons of raking tools out there, and their whole idea is to get a lot of pins moving with a lot of randomness as much as you can, as fast as you can. But this is a fun thing that doesn't involve rakes.
Right, so our half diamond, the characteristic I was talking about earlier is we can put it in the cylinder, we can put it in the cylinder what we would think of as upside down, and we can raise it up as high as we can. So the springs are completely retracted. And when we slowly pull the pick out of the lock, what's going to happen is we're going to hear the pins slamming down. If there's five pins, you're going to hear slam, 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 slam. And that gives you an idea not only how many pins are in the lock, but it also helps you visually represent how close the pins are to each other and how close the tolerances are in that regard. So very useful. Before you get to the point where you're, you know, just looking at a lock and you know every single characteristic about it just by looking at it, this is a good learning exercise. So several people have mentioned this already, but one of the most important tools is your turning tool. Someone said, I don't recall who, but someone said that picking is 90% tension and 10% tool selection usage. So what that means is, you know, the tension is very, very important. When I pick, and I know a lot of people do this as well, they put the lock in the palm of their hand, the keyway facing either direction, it doesn't matter, but the palm goes in the palm of your hand, the tension wrench goes to the bottom or top of the keyway, and the index finger completely extended is used to, that was a trip. The index finger is used to apply tension to the lock. So that is the way you should be replicating as well. If you look at your finger and there's blood leaving the tip.
Yeah, like that.
I mean, not only are you going to wear out your hand, I mean, your hand is going to start to hurt. You know, that's too much tension. You're applying too much tension. The lock's going to have
pressure.
A very hard time opening. So save yourself by being gentle. This is really important. And oftentimes what happens is people will go at this very seriously. They'll start picking for the first time, and they'll...
That's not a staged photo, too. That
this is what they look like.
Those people.
Those people yeah. Right, okay. Yeah. Anyways, so the point that I'm trying to make is oftentimes you'll give up hope very quickly. No pun intended, but you'll give up, and you'll start just messing with the lock subconsciously. You'll engage in a conversation with your neighbor. You'll start thinking of something else. You'll turn on the TV, and the lock will fall open in your hands, and you'll be like, what did I just do? The first time you do open a lock, you do kind of feel like God. It's really cool. All these doors literally will open in front of your eyes once you know how to pick locks. I mean, it's really a powerful tool if used in the right manner. So I'm going to let Deves talk about this particular slide.
Yeah, so like happy kittens, right? Of course. I'm a cat owner. My cats are at a friend's house because I'm moving. But yeah, so obviously when you get a lock open, we haven't actually been respecting this enough up here, but it's like, open, you got to say, open. Or if you're Ray, you say, offen. And then all the Dutch guys go, grr, German, beat me. So yeah, like... Tell us, you know, that's the big thing in this culture is the idea of, like, open. We want to hear it when you get locks open in the village. We'll try to say it more up here. It looks like we're showing off, but that's the idea. What would prevent this from working? What would prevent a lock from opening? Well, there are pick-resistant locks. So seeing what you have, how many of you, again, I love the hands because I love the audience. Mechanically, did that diagram make sense? Like, it's clear? You understand those imperfections? You understand how they bind and why they happen? Well, if lock picking, essentially lock picking is an inversion of the normal way you interact with a lock, right? Normally, you push the pins with the key, then you turn. It's push, then turn. Lock picking is just turn, then push. So it's mechanically, it's a very simple process, and you did a beautiful explanation of it. Well, what could interfere with that process? What could interfere with the idea of picking? Pick-resistant pins are an easy way that manufacturers can stop this sort of mechanical action of turn first. If you have a pin that's not a pure cylinder, if it's in this case spool-shaped, like a little spool of thread, this is called a spool pin, the idea would be turning pressure causes that lip to kick over. It causes that lip to splay out to the side, and then if you try to turn and then lift, that spool pin isn't actually going to let you lift correctly. Now, that doesn't mean it's impossible, right?
Well, it just makes it more challenging eventually, right? The lock manufacturers use these. They don't use them widespread because it is more expensive, obviously, to manufacture these more precise, pins in general. But once you understand how they operate, it really just adds another piece to the puzzle, and it makes it more exciting and more fun, and you get to keep moving on once you've mastered the basic pin tumbler lock. So these aren't something to be afraid of. They're something to embrace and conquer and you know, learn the different intricacies of the pins themselves. And so I wanted to say something earlier. I don't remember. Continue.
Okay. So the idea, when people first see this diagram, they say, wow, so it jams it up and, you know, you can't get by it, can you? Well, let's look at it a little more closely. And I'm just going to imagine what's happening over my shoulder because of presenter mode. But when the pin is jammed up, when the plug is turned and the spool is caught on a lip, you have the contact points between the driver pin, that blue pin, and the key pin in red. They're very splayed apart. If you push a little harder underneath on that pin, the mechanical action, what the pins want to do is kind of bring that gap back to true a little bit. So the two black lines that show some rotational position here, you can see it gets kicked over, it gets jammed up, and then if you push a little harder underneath the spool pin that's binding, you can get the plug to actually back rotate just a hair. And that will, you know, occlude that gap shut, and then you can kind of pop around the spool. Now, a few things are going to happen there. One, you need even less pressure on that turning tool. And we got into some of the analogies. I love your analogy. Bobbix explains the turning pressure. Normally, think of like a keyboard, like a membrane keyboard, a laptop keyboard, less pressure than you need on that key. Think of if the turning tool were flat, just stacking some coins on it, that's enough pressure. Even less pressure than that is what you're doing if you're trying to get past a spool. Extra pressure underneath, which we told you earlier, you might overlift, you might jam up. But all of that, the most frustrating thing is that back rotation can cause pins you had set to then unset in other chambers. So spools are quite the frustration all around, but it is absolutely possible to get by them. It's possible to probe for them, to find out where they might be. A lot of times you'll hear people, if you know, you pass them, hey man, this lock's a real pain in the ass. There's a spool in chamber three. Like, you know, people talk to each other about that. But getting around them, it is possible.
That's an example of the kind of information you would only get picking pin by pin. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to be able to tell which pin chamber has a spool if you're just raking. You might be able to tell their spools, but you won't be able to tell where they are.
You're not helping your argument. Sorry.
So there's a lot of pick-resistant pins. There's a lot of interesting designs.
Open
a mushroom pin. The idea is if you make the pick-resistant pin with sides that will drag more along the plug wall, this will create longer periods of friction. Obviously, what's the disadvantage here? Well, that pin is not reversible. Spool pins, a giant machining operation can load them into a hopper. And as the lock plugs are coming along and the housing's coming along an assembly line, a machine can just feed them down. Something like a mushroom pin, this is something a locksmith is ordering and he or she is pinning by hand, and they're actually orienting things correctly. Serrated pins, I don't know how well this shows up on the screen for y'all in the back, but like just pins that have grooves down the entire thing. There was a famous lock picker and locksmith named Jerry Finch. He worked with Lab and other companies later on. He was a huge advocate for spool pins. And in the latest proof of concept, or get the fuck out, the one that Travis Goodspeed puts out, I wrote an article about spool pins and how Jerry advocated actually scoring the inside of your plug walls to make them jam up even harder. Speaking of that, some companies have really done micro machining, and like there's a Swedish company, Asa. Asa loves to make this crazy-ass pin, which Hanfei, our friend from Holland, calls the sneaky pin. It's, you know, basically a double spool, but look at the plug. The plug has little counter-milled notches right at the top of its chambers that cause positive lockup. This is the old Asa 700. It's an old lock. I think there's, what, like four or five people in the world that might be crazy or drunk enough to pick this? Like, Arthurmeister probably would try. And then he would yell and throw it and talk to Marina. But it's possible to do really interesting things just with your basic pin tumbler design. It's going to cost a lot more, because that's a question we get a lot too. People say, oh, those imperfections, well, couldn't you just make the lock, you know, more precise? Yeah. you couldn't sell it at Home Depot for $10. You know, there's a difference between a CAD diagram and a piece of metal in your hand. Anybody can make a CAD diagram and be like, I'm Bob's Lock Company and I'm going to make locks. Then you call the factory and you say, hello, I want to make locks. And they say, wait, ni chile ma.
No,
you forgot. Say, oh, I need someone who speaks Mandarin.
You forgot the part that you start a Kickstarter first.
Yeah, you start a Kickstarter to make locks, exactly.
Right.
Better than lockpicks. But yeah, like you're going to be on the phone with somebody at a factory that's going to say, well, what are your machining tolerances? How precise is this engineering? And if you want them, oh, I want them down to like, you know, the 10 microns. And they're like, okay, we can do that. Your supply part cost is $500. And you're like, wow, I'm trying to sell these for $4.99 on the corner bodega. So that's why all this happens. It's a trade-off of cost and engineering. And how often do we encounter spool? Like in the U.S., what would you guys say? Like maybe half the locks you encounter in a commercial environment might have a spool in what? Like
much less than that.
Yeah. Oh, residential, you're not getting spools except for one or two like nice brands.
And it opens up the
lock. Yost has a really screwed up look on his face right now because he's like, seriously?
What are the locks like in Holland?
The reason we say that is because, Yost, what would you say in the EU, what percentage of locks, even the cheap ones that you buy, you know, like Castorama or something, how many of those have spool pins?
Well, if you go to the equivalent of, let's say, Home Depot in the Netherlands, the lower shelf, maybe not. That's about it.
But everything else is going to have spool pins.
Yeah. I mean, if you buy them at, less than a fiver, then there's a chance they won't have a spool pin. That's about it.
And there's an important point here, too, is that not everybody needs super high security locks. Yet, generally, when you go to more populated areas like the EU, the several urban areas in the U.S., the cities, you're going to find higher security locks just by nature of the need for more security. And the same thing applies in the cybersecurity world as well.
We're just a much more secure country. We don't need all those crazy spool pins. That's
we
what the NSA
guns.
Told me.
Europe doesn't.
NSA told me that you don't need spool pins. Don't worry. It's okay.
You have guns.
We're here to protect you.
It's also important to say that even though these layers have been added to the lock to prevent you from opening them, they do not prevent against all types of attacks when you talk holistically about security and locks in general. There are many other attacks that even the most precisely manufactured locks that may be very, very, very hard to pick open will be vulnerable to other attacks like bumping, which we'll slightly touch on in a little bit. So if you're talking about security, again, in the holistic sense, you know, we're talking about specific areas or specific types of vulnerabilities.
So Doug Farr with an excellent intro. Thank you, Doug. No, don't forget that. That's the important part. All right. So there's another topic now. This is not so much about opening locks. Well, I guess in a way it is. In a bit. So there's an interesting ethical discussion that it kind of never really happened across a lot of groups and across a lot of, other than a few posts on a mailing list. The topic of love picking is something we wanted to bat around for a minute and then even get your feedback and talk about, especially in a city like New York. So I don't know how familiar people are in this room with the idea of love locks, this notion that it was originally in an Italian film, like this bad romance movie, where a young couple, you know, puts a lock on a bridge and, you know, they throw the key away. And because of this film, this phenomenon has grown. It started to spread originally through parts of Europe, and then it became really popular around other places.
Raise your hand if you've seen this
in
person.
Like, how many people have seen maybe not
it's
this?
It's reasonably popular.
So this has become a huge cultural phenomenon, and it's become a phenomenon here even in the U.S.
How much does that fence weigh right now?
Yeah.
You know, that
it's,
looks
it's
like
a problem. The bridge wasn't designed to carry that many locks and people at the same time.
Yeah, so like things like this happen.
To me, that looks like a lot of free locks.
Well, that's part of the discussion,
basically. Yeah.
That's my view.
So these are a lot of us who love locks, who enjoy them, I should say, who enjoy locks in general, think love locks are beautiful. We think it's a cool sentiment. We think it looks gorgeous. Like Skyler, he's a fanatic for love locks. He has all these great photos. But municipalities do not agree. So cities actually consider this a maintenance problem. They consider it a public nuisance. Here in New York and other places especially, they just have crews that go around and cut these locks off of bridges very regularly. And if you walk across the Williamsburg Bridge or the Brooklyn Bridge, you'll see like shackles that are kind of thrown around because they're trying to collect all these locks and there are these droppings that occur. So there's become a new movement called love picking. And the idea, it's very mixed. So some people are just non-romantics and they just want to, you know, open locks and be like, screw you, lovers. And other people are very territorial.
They've had their hearts broken.
So like Sean Nichols and the Irish Cats in Love Lock No More in Dublin, the Haypenny Bridge, they pick just to like clean their bridge. They think it's a public space issue. And other, like in Tool, we skirt the middle ground. We pick some locks, or we did until there was a big boardroom Skype call where people were upset. And we did it to preserve the locks because we thought they were gorgeous and thought it was a shame they were being thrown away.
There's two core philosophies here that are at odds with each other, and this is where we'd like your opinion in the audience. On one hand, you have from the lock picker's perspective, look at all these great and sometimes really beautiful locks that are just going to be cut, right? So this is a maintenance issue. The cities are cutting them. Wouldn't it be nice if instead we save these locks by picking them and then reusing them in perhaps another art installation or something like that? The other perspective, the other side of this is, well, you don't own those locks. Those locks don't belong to you. And even though they've been abandoned, it is not your charge to pick them open and take them off. You shouldn't be the person doing that.
Rule number one applies.
Right, exactly. Don't pick locks you don't own. And that's an honorable and worthy rule as well. So, again, these two sides are at odds with each other because at the end of the day, the locks are going to go. They're either going to be cut or they're going to be picked, or the original owners are going to come back and, you know, if they still have the key for some reason, maybe they found the key on the bottom of the river, they open it again for some reason. But this is the question at hand right now.
Yeah, like look at these. These are just a small sampling of the locks that Tool has preserved and some of our friends have preserved over the years. These all would have been thrown away. These all would have been in a dumpster. And instead, each one of them has been wrapped in basically red felt and put in the Tool office, waiting for the culmination of a project that we'll tell you about in a minute. Before we tell you about that project, Ray is going to tell you about an interesting project for two or three slides here.
Yeah, I had the problem of, what's the problem, but I wanted to give a love lock to a friend of mine who got married.
Oh,
and I didn't
cable.
Want
Where's
to...
the cable?
We can change to here. Wanted to rely on the moral discussion of the people coming to the bridge with the lock hangs. So I thought, let's look inside the mechanism. I'll go back to the slide.
Okay.
The slide is not there.
One more time. Press.
No, we lost the screen for a second. Let's
see. Deviant lost the screen.
Oh.
Drink.
Okay, the first thing I realized is that...
There we go.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the plug and the mechanical part of the lock which operates the shackle are divided by a space, and there are two interacting parts. So I thought I can just saw them off and put a spacer between. So in this lock here...
Yeah, so do you guys see that plug no longer operates the operating cylinder at all now? Like, it's completely divorced.
The cam has been disconnected.
Yeah, the cam is disconnected. So this looks like a real lock.
Yeah, so, and you can easily engrave them with a laser cutter. So I basically engraved the lock. This is here for the conference, but the other one I engraved, of course, with the names of the couple. And detached the plug from the upper part. So you can pick the lock as often as you want, but it won't open the lock anymore. So I don't have to care about the moral issues of the people coming to the bridge. And if you want to try, I'll actually put one of these locks somewhere here at the conference, I think near the lock-picking area. I think it can be opened by manipulating somehow my returning disk, but have a look at it. Have
All
fun.
Right. So very cool, the super love lock, apparently. But so people asked us, when we were on the Brooklyn Bridge and other bridges, people asked us a lot. They said, hey, what are you out here? Because there's a real, how many people, if you liked a love lock and you saw someone picking it, you might be like, hey, what are you doing? That's my representation of forever and poetry and birds. you know. So,
well, now, there's a lot of people laughing, but I do feel that there is probably a very significant number of people who feel just as strongly.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm not trying to dismiss. I'm a romantic at heart, you know.
And you have to remember, every time you pick a love lock, the couple gets divorced.
That's the reason.
Some people are more sentimental than others.
So when people asked us, why are you doing this? Why? And we would explain, you realize if we don't cut these off, like the city of New York, the Port Authority is going to cut these off. They're going to throw them away. And they said, well, why is it any better that you're picking them? Well, Moscow, Russia has started something, and I don't know of it in any other cities yet. We've reached out, that is to say, I've reached out to the press and public relations offices of the New York Department of Transportation and Port Authority, not getting any response. But we love the idea of this, of lovelock trees. So a bridge in Moscow was very weighted with locks, and it was a problem. And they had a public, installation of art. They had a metal worker make this gorgeous metal tree, and they installed it right on the foot of the bridge. And they encouraged people to put their locks on the tree instead. And they said, look, you can put them on the bridge. Like, we might ticket you if we see you, which is currently in New York. You can get in trouble for putting them on the bridge. But they said, if you put them on the bridge, ticket or not, like, they're going to get cut off. They're going to get thrown away. If you put them on the tree, it lives there forever. And I think that is gorgeous. It's to our mission. If there's anybody out there who has any pull, like, we got journalists here. It's a great human interest story. Come on. Get someone on the phone from the Bridge Commission or from, New York Department of whomever. We will raise funds for this. We will work with public metal workers for this and the steel workers and the artisans. We want to see, like, literally a tree rusts in Brooklyn. Like, that's what we want to see. We want to see a lovelock tree. And if one of these gets erected, all the locks we've picked, we're going to put on the tree kind of as starter locks, and other people will see it. And hopefully, I think it's freaking beautiful. But other than that, the idea of whether it's ethical, like, lovelocks keep spreading. Yep. And I don't know how the trend ends. I don't know what cities are going to do. And I don't know what people think is right and wrong. But there's got to be a key to solving this issue. And I'd like to hear from the panel. Yeah, I'd like to hear from you guys.
Dev, I totally agree on the beauty of that tree. I mean, that's a very good alternative. But that doesn't mean we're allowed to pick the locks that are on the bridge. That's my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Dutch chapter is a bit more strict on this one. We see it as the same as taking a lock from a bridge, a love lock from a bridge. It equals to stealing coins from a wishing well. And it's metal, and somebody put that in there with some significance in their point of view, and we're taking it away. And yes, the locks will be taken away eventually, anyhow, even without us doing it, but now we're not. Because, well, the ground rules of picking start with, do not pick a lock that you don't owe or have specific permission from the owner of picking it. And, well, the question is the bridge owner the owner of the lock that happens to be on that bridge? So I think the media, the potential media shitstorm that we're undoing some holy bond between two people, I don't want that. So I'm quite against it.
Yeah.
Sorry, there's questions.
Is the crowd mic working? We'll repeat your question if it's not.
Yes. Okay. So you said that you were reaching out to the city about this. I mean, what if you guys reached out to cities to say, let's cooperate, let's make this a thing? You're going to cut them off anyway. Mm-hmm. Let's make it a thing and make it publicly known that instead of cutting them off, people will lockpick them. And they will either get lockpicked or they will get... So it's a known thing, and it's within the realm of permission.
It's a shallow line.
What's the difference between, picking it or cutting it off if everybody knows that you have permission to do so?
Well, I'm not going to cut them off.
No, no, that's the difference.
No, I'm not going to cut them off.
The city is going to cut them
off. Sure, they can do that.
If you're already cooperating with the city, instead of you guys cutting them off, let us go and pick them for you. as a service to the city. You're saving the city money.
I think that's a far-fetched idea that any city would align themselves with a hacking organization.
It's a beautiful idea.
It's wonderful.
I'm
There was an example of a town in, I think, California that published a hackathon in Oakland, weekly newsletter saying, come learn how to pick locks, and the media backlash of the city aligning with an organization that was teaching lockpicking was just unbelievable.
All right, well, here's some more backstory on that, because I think we can talk about this for a second. We can talk about this for a second because Tool was the organization that was affected by this directly. So in the city of Oakland, California, which, as you guys know, has a very, very low crime rate and is known for its safety, there's some workshop weekends. They do a lot of science-y, hacky stuff to, you know, share knowledge and, you know, kind of encourage the idea of learning and stuff like that.
From learn to solder to, baking in the kitchen.
All sorts of stuff, you know, biohacking and this and that. And one of the workshops that our San Francisco chapter was doing was about lockpicking, which is cool, right? Now, the mayor had a newsletter, her office, rather, had a newsletter that, you know, promotes local community events.
Just stuff going on in Oakland.
Stuff going
really
on
pasted
in Oakland.
With a lot of mismatched font.
Right.
You know, just copy-paste.
Now, imagine you're just looking for cool stuff going on in your city to post in the newsletter, and someone in the office saw, oh, cool, lockpicking. Yeah, that's cool. We'll put that in the newsletter. So then all the residents in the city of Oakland received this newsletter that said, hey, residents of this city that is having so many problems with crime, please come learn how to pick locks. And I think, as you can imagine, there was concern in the community. The act of learning how to pick locks by itself, of course, does not make you a criminal, but it was a sensitive issue, and perhaps it wasn't dealt with in the newsletter in the most politically correct way, I guess is a good way of putting it. And so that resulted in
local press, which then resulted in regional press, which is Bay Area. And I don't know if anyone came in from the West Coast, but what is the number three priority of the San Francisco press? Pissing all over Oakland and saying how much better San Francisco is. So yeah, it was the San. Who was that dick? Chip or Skip? Whatever. Somebody in the San Francisco Chronicle made a huge, you know, hit piece about it and how Mayor Jean Kwan doesn't know what she's doing, and it turned into this massive, oh my God, I can't believe the crimes, the terrors.
For like a day.
Yeah, for like a day, and then it died out.
People got bored.
So the idea of lockpicking as a topic in general really fans a lot of flames of, it gets people very impassioned. And it happens with love locks, it happens with workshops. How many of you go home from a HackerCon and you say, oh, I bought a set of lockpicks, I could, you know, my brother or sister, let me teach young Timmy. And they're like, hey, what are you teaching my child? You know, it's a very hot topic issue. So, yeah, I mean, we heard from Jos, our view on it was that these are abandoned property. That's how we told ourselves, maybe we were not being honest with ourselves, if you want to be critical of us. We told ourselves that it wasn't violating the law of don't pick locks you don't own, because we said, well, what if it's like, don't, you know, these are locks like no one owns. They're just abandoned property. So I don't know if that's a stretch. I would really like to hear more from what people think. And is that a hand there? Or, yeah, go ahead, sir.
Mike.
We'll repeat, too. Go ahead.
You know, when people fish, they'll have, like, catch and release. Have you ever thought of just picking the lock and then putting it back? You know, to maintain the symbolism.
Catch and release.
Yeah. Well, there's a problem with that. I mean, if you're halfway picking, you're picking. So if people question you then, I know there's a story about ethics. That's a story that did not happen. Let's start off with that. It was a thought process that Skylar explained me once that made perfectly sense. Imagine you're driving along to an interstate or whatever it's called here, and it's dark and it's late, and you end up, you pass a store that is closed. You have money. You want a soda. You see the soda behind the locked door. You have the money. So I'll just pick this door open and exchange the soda for money and pick the door closed again. With all the best intentions in the world, I wouldn't go there.
Yeah. That's a cool analogy, yeah.
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 So maybe we can do an informal poll. I mean, this is not a proper sample because we have a probably very skewed sample here of the populace, I would say, in a good way.
Very but ethical people here.
I think so.
Yeah.
I do.
So you don't have to if you don't want to, but if you think that we should stick to the Netherlands original rule book and say, you know what, you don't own the lock, it's not your lock, you didn't put it there, don't pick it. Even if someone else is going to cut it, don't pick it. Who thinks that's the way we should be operating?
Right? Stick to
that's
the Dutch.
That's a significant portion. Okay.
And how about the furthest of the other end of the spectrum, what we deluded ourselves a bit saying, this is abandoned property, and if we're doing it for an ethical reason, to preserve them, it's okay to pick them. Anybody?
It's about the same.
A little more there, yeah. I'd like to think, but you know.
I think the middle way would be, and that's very elaborate, is if somebody would come up to me and said, me and my girlfriend, or me and my boyfriend, whatever, we have a lock that's on that bridge.
Yeah.
We know it's going to cut. Please join me to opening
that. I thought you were going
to
say, we broke up, so can you help me?
Miss,
you have a question as well, or a comment.
So my comment is that picking a lock that somebody else has put there is kind of like cutting off a bike from where it's been connected. Mm-hmm. Not that I have any judgment one way or the other,
because sure.
That could be an abandoned bike. Mm-hmm. But people might come back for their lock.
Yeah.
They might do it symbolically and then come back a year
right.
later and,
oh, yeah.
and want it. So there's, I have no moral connection, but I just wanted to give some analysis.
That's a valid point. Yeah. And we actually haven't said this publicly. Thank you, Biz. We haven't really mentioned it. After the talk we had, Tool doesn't participate in any love picking days anymore. We've been leaving the bridges alone. We are just waiting to hear back from the city and from the public. And we're really ultimately waiting for a love lock tree. That's what we really hope to find. But that's where everything stands right now. And gentlemen, yes, and then we'll move on to impressioning.
So when you get the love lock tree, if and when that does indeed happen, picking them from the bridge and relocating them to the tree doesn't create an ethical issue, correct?
I don't know if it does or not.
Here's my thought. So I think from the perspective of the people who put the locks there, if the lock is being placed there as a symbolic gesture, then it's irrelevant if the lock can be picked or cut. That's not why you put it there, right? I mean, obviously you know that it can be cut. You know that in theory it could be picked. You place the lock there because it represents something intangible. It represents something that you can't... It's a physical representation of something that is only a thought, an idea, a feeling. And the having someone pick it open, just because the lock is still physically there, the fact that it's been picked open for a lot of those people might feel that, you know, something has been hurt or damaged in some way. And that's what we want to be sensitive to. So my personal take is if this is something that is to succeed, this is what would have to happen. We would have to get the cooperation of a municipality. They would have to install the trees and say, like, okay, you know, and make a big media thing out of it. These are the trees where, like, if you're a couple and you want to place a love lock somewhere, please place it on this tree, on these trees that we've created for this purpose. The bridges were not designed for this purpose. It does cause damage. It costs us money. It costs you, the taxpayer, money. Please don't do that. We're going to use the trees. And at some point in the future, on such and such a date or after such and such a time, we'll be removing all the locks from the bridge. Any that can be picked will be moved to the tree. Otherwise, the locks will be removed and destroyed. And if you announce that, you know, and leave, like, you know, a year of time or something like that, I think, in my opinion, that's kind of a happy middle ground. But I think the idea of just kind of back-channeling communication, going to the city saying, hey, you guys mind if we pick these locks? And they're like, ah, sure, whatever. That gives the original owners zero time to respond and say, well, no, I don't want you to pick that. If anything, I'm going to come back and take the lock myself.
Well, at the risk of being insensitive, I just want to ask, are we really to the point where sentiment is more important than wasting a huge amount of resources, regardless of
yes,
the
we do
situation?
That all the time.
But
all the time.
Okay, well, I guess I'm a realist. But.
Libertarians.
Yeah.
Oh.
Just one more point from my view. I'm from Germany, and we have a beautiful bridge over the River Rhine in Cologne, mm-hmm. with hundreds of thousands of locks. Meanwhile, it's a security issue. They have to go, because the bridge is used by trains,
yeah.
And they have tripled the way.
Yes,
meanwhile.
It's a real problem,
and it's
absolutely.
A real thing, and
it's
they
true,
have
but
to
it's
go.
It's not
and,
something and from, that a sports and, group should solve.
Sorry, and I think they have to go. And if somebody decides they have to go for security reasons, in my opinion, it's better than one of you guys or a couple of you guys go there and take the locks away, instead of the fire brigade or something, somebody else who cuts them away.
Thank you.
As a hobbyist sports lockpicker, some of us still feel that the city is not able to give that permission for us to open that lock. Yes. It would have to be the person who put the lock on, regardless of whether they were allowed to put that lock there. We as hobbyist lockpickers have a code of ethics that we follow very strictly, and some of us don't feel like we're allowed to open that lock for any reason.
I would like to ask Jagor and Jos something. What if a municipality came and said, we're going to hire, not us, what if they hire a locksmith to remove the locks non-destructively? Would they be allowed to do that?
They're not bound by our code of ethics.
Okay.
I mean, if the police ask you to open up a door because some criminals are in, that's valid, yeah.
What if some people within the organization were hired at zero charge by the locksmith temporarily as in a professional capacity, as an official employee on paper,
temporary
and
apprentice?
Then that company was contracted by the city to remove the locks?
That's frowned upon. If you're wearing a tool shirt, I'll get
it sounds
you.
Like you're not acting as a hobbyist lockpicker at that point. You're okay. becoming
yeah,
a temporary
yeah.
locksmith.
Okay.
I would say.
All right. So it's, maybe that's part of where the line is whether you're acting as a hobbyist lockpicker.
It's gray.
It's gray,
yeah.
Sure. But we're trying to figure out where that line
yeah.
is.
I don't like gray in this area. ethics shouldn't be gray.
Well, that's the nature of ethics.
That's a fair point.
Well, but it shouldn't be.
The debate about ethics should always be gray, and then eventually you decide where you stand.
Let's take one final comment.
One final comment,
and then we'll go on to the next topic.
We're still dropping real knowledge on you in a
second. Yeah,
Yos,
we just wanted to segue to this.
In.
Not, we're not going to use up the rest of the time with this topic.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Yes, sir.
Hi. What if I locked myself to a bridge? Would you have to ask my permission to or pick the lock without my permission, you know?
What if you locked yourself to a bridge?
Yeah. All right, next question.
Then the police will come and delicately and politely swab mace in your eyes until you move. And the National Lawyers Guild will have the green hats, and they'll be documenting the whole thing to make sure your rights are protected while your eyes are burning. Jesus. Yeah, so by the way, we're gonna do impressioning, which is a totally different technique, and Jos is going to speak about that. I don't think this was incredibly rewarding, at least for us up here. We don't get to debate this. We don't get to have all these voices that normally we wish we had when we were just sitting around in bars. So thank you so much for indulging us on that. And we're going to pepper in some other little fun stuff, but now it's hard knowledge time too.
Do we want to wait? Do we want to give 10 minutes to the audience?
I think we can get through this, and then it's going to be the 10-minute break. That's
okay.
What the plan is. Is that all right? Your bladders are holding out. You still have filled drinks.
I see.
Still want to learn?
Up. Good. All right.
All right.
Let's
Yo,
get some
stay
real,
away.
Real knowledge.
Hey, I'll try to. Is this working? It's not that loud, is it?
I'll try that.
Well, they can adjust the volume. If you start talking, they'll adjust for it.
Or you can talk from here, whatever.
Or that.
I'm talking from here. That's okay if you don't mind.
Oh, damn it.
Hello.
Yeah, what's happening?
There you go. I didn't do nothing.
Deeb's fixing it.
Is that me?
You got it? Click forward.
Yeah,
there you go.
There you go. Impressioning. You start off, impressioning is opening a lock, because that's what we do. We're sports lock pickers. And instead of starting with nothing, with thin air and a couple of tools, we start off with something that looks like a key. But as you see, it's an uncut key. It's a key like you would see at the wall of a locksmith. So it's not cut to code yet.
It's a blank key.
It's a blank. And it should, at the end, look like this, because we all know this, well, if that's correct code, this will open your lock. So the idea is how to get from this to this. Okay. We use the same flaws in the lock that we use for lock picking, but we use them the other way around. Let me explain. If you put a blank key in the lock, it won't open the lock. Because the same as with... The same as with lock picking, if you turn the key, then if you're picking, then blue stuff is in the way and now the red ones are, so because now there's a hunk of metal in the middle. And if you turn it, same as in lock picking, one or two of the pins, mostly one, will start to bind. That will be crushed to the side, and other ones will move freely. And because a key always has tolerances in your lock, and it has to have, because if there was no tolerance between your lock and your key, it would be almost impossible to get the key in, especially after a couple of drinks. That would be a problem. So what you can do if you put this key in is wiggle it a bit. I mean, if you put it in, you can move it just a tiny bit. Now, if you turn that key ever so slightly, because, I mean, you can't turn it, but if you try to turn it and move it up and down, in this case, this pin stack is binding, so the other ones aren't. If you move that key up and down, you will see that all these pin stacks, all their moving up is spring pressure. So you're only pushing up the spring. And that one pin that's not, it has more pressure because it's stuck to the side. And of course, being a key, you can turn it the other side, and with any luck, that would happen on another pin stack also.
Yeah.
Now what happens,
yeah,
you have
Can you guys see? It's hard to read. They can't read their little black part. I don't know. Can you see? The yellow says bind.
It says bind. This says rub.
Rub.
So basically, this is a piece of metal that's pushing against another piece of metal. At this point and this point, there's more pressure than the other ones. Do we get that?
You guys see why it's multiple pins? It's turned one way and wiggle, then turn the other way and wiggle, because you get different pins binding.
With some luck. I mean, could be the same. But, I mean, ideally you have two spots. Well, because there's metal pushing into metal, with some luck, you'll end up with ever so tiny, dense, scratches, markings on your blank. With the proper magnification and some training, you learn to interpret those marks. What you can do, what you know by then, is that if there's a mark, that pin didn't want to, was not springy, so it was not at the correct level. So, and because we started off with a fresh blank key, it was too high. So what we can do is, at that point and that point, where the tiny marks are, take a bit of metal off, get one step deeper. It's still not a working key, so we rinse and repeat. We put the key in, we turn to the left, rub, rub, we turn to the right, wiggle, wiggle. And so that one is still binding, so it'll make a mark. That one is still binding, so it will make a mark. So we get, in the valleys we just created, our new marks. So
how many people can see the tiny black marks on the key? Yeah, you can see it?
Tiny.
Okay, good, good, good.
Okay, well, they're there. And and this is actually quite correct, because normally if you have a mark on a key, you don't see it from that far off. You need some magnification and some light and whatever. And we'll have a video of that later. And so what you do, because there's markings, still not the correct depth, so there and there, so we take off more material. This could go on for hours. So now we rinse and repeat again. We put it in the lock and start wiggling. But, wait a minute. At position 4, that one is no longer binding. Because this pin stack is on the correct height. So if you turn it now, this one will probably still bind
to the other ones. But instead of this one, with any luck, a new pin stack will be the one that's binding first.
Do you guys get it? Like, it's not binding, so it shouldn't mark, it shouldn't rub, there shouldn't be anything on the blade of the key.
So this is a combination of exploiting two properties of pin tumbler locks. One is the tolerance issue in the chambers that allows pins to bind in the first place. That's how we pick locks, right? And on top of that, on top of the existing vulnerability, there's the fact that the key, when it goes into the lock, has some slop, right? The key has to be slightly smaller than the keyway that it fits into, just to make sure that you always can insert it and remove it.
You don't stick a key in, and it's not like every time you stick a key in. It's got a little bit of room.
So you're binding the pins, so now the pins are not moving as much. And just that little bit of slop in the key, when you push it up and down, that's what's making the marks that Yost is talking about.
And a typical key blank works for this. Just make that clear. This isn't, we don't need specific keys designed for this process.
Actually, we tried a whole bunch of very specific keys. Don't go there. The normal factory blank seems to be the best material for this. So regular brass, that's good. We tried aluminium. We tried steel. We tried several plastics. Maybe there's a magic unicorn out there, but we haven't found them yet.
So. Yeah, I mean, we run training classes, and invariably, one of our students, Babak and I, will have a student that'll either ask one of two things. They'll say, "Couldn't you make the keys much softer? Because the marks would be so much easier to see."
Who sees the problem with softer keys?
Then another student says, "Couldn't you make the keys much harder? Because I keep breaking my keys." And, like, it's a completely double-edged sword. The whole thing, by the way, about the super light turning pressure, throw that out the window. This is a process of really hard, hard torque pressure.
Yeah, it's finding the correct torque that will not break your key if you apply it over and over and over. And, of course, if you get better at it, you can do it in less steps. So you can use more force. Because it won't break that hard.
Yeah, we have some good slides with your Kruplin is in the slides.
Yeah, I mean, if you have hours and hours to do this, you can do it easy and easy and easy. But if you do this in competition, there is that fine line between too much pressure and too less. Because if you use too much, it'll break. If you use too less, it probably won't mark. And so more pressure will probably give better marks, but it will break earlier. So
I want to just stress that this technique of basically manufacturing a key for a lock that will open the lock without first having access to the original is very much a technique that anyone here could start doing at home, on their own without any advanced instruction. And that's kind of the theme of some of the stuff we've been talking about here is that the barrier to entry is very low. So.
Yeah, the key part is interpreting pressure points and filing neatly. So you have, two markings on another spot, and so they have to go there and there. Well, there's no one left anymore because that's
gone.
A correct height. That's gone. And there's a new one there instead of this one. So then we file that one. And you can rinse and repeat and repeat and repeat until you come up with a working key. Yeah. And that's the process. Yeah.
So you guys get this, right? There's no picks involved whatsoever.
Actually, you're in competition, that's very much not involved.
You're only walking up to the door with a key and eventually making a work. It's freaking powerful attack.
Yeah, and especially if you're in a red team operation or something like that and you get stopped, you're carrying a key, man.
The key maker in the Matrix is just really good at impressioning. That's how he does it.
We have to apologize for bringing up the second and third Matrix movies. But,
It wasn't that bad.
Okay, so the problem is interpreting spots, interpreting, reading the marks, and then it is filing. So, there's a mark here. Anyone can spot it? It's not the best
video.
If
you count from the shoulder as position 1, 2, all the way out to the tip,
shout out which position
is the mark.
That's correct. It's 2. There's more people on front that see it than in the back. That kind of makes sense. There it is. And who's that then?
Who's that awesome guy?
I have no idea. And the other one is you're using quite some force on the key. I will advise against doing that with just your bare hands. I mean, I'm pretty sure some people are able to do that, but not in competition. I mean, if you're properly training for competition, you'll ruin several boxes of blanks on a weekend. If you do that with your bare hands, good luck with that next round. That's not going to happen. So this is a commercially available grip that's especially designed for impressioning. It even says so. If you get the proper slides, you can see that. But I had a tool maker in the Netherlands, being Jort Knaap, make this for me. Well, first of all, it's bling. So that's points.
It's bling.
It's bling.
Bling.
And it has lever. What would you call this?
Yeah, a lever.
It's
a
lever.
Yeah,
it's a post that enables you to turn it easier.
That's all just for torque. He wants to put serious torque without hurting his wrist.
Yeah, and not just without hurting my wrist. That's the key part. Because what you normally do, you grip that grip and turn it quite forcefully, and then kind of subtly move it up and down. So you're gripping quite hard, turning it quite hard, and then doing subtle things. That's going to hurt. If you do boxes at a time of blanks, that will hurt. If you do it like this, you can just turn it at that lever and then be gentle. So you turn it with your left hand and wiggle it with your right, and that feels way more natural.
Sounds so bad.
That's what she said.
That she did say that, actually. And the fun part is you have more control also, because it's not that crampy and you move it up and down. You basically put that attack into several stages, so that's good. I really like this. The other one, the tip is, file straight, because if it's not dead on the correct angle, then maybe you will open the lock. But it will only turn one way. Yeah. I mean,
the analogy I love is if you stay up too late at night and you watch like ESPN9 or whatever that has professional pool players, a really good pool player, like any drunk asshole in a bar can like, oh, we're gonna make this shot, and like you can make the shot. A professional pool player isn't thinking about this shot; they're thinking about the next shot and where their cue ball is gonna land on the table. A really good impressioner isn't just thinking, my file is removing metal. They're thinking about setting up the key for the next pass of marks and observation. So they want to leave a really clean, flat surface.
Yes. It has to be clean and flat, ideally, because, I mean, in the same plane. It doesn't have to be shiny. Imagine a field freshly plowed. Is that the term? Freshly
mowed,
whatever.
Well, you could plow a field or mow it, depending on what you're going for.
Plowed.
No, that's not an innuendo. I'm talking about farming. Okay. Jesus Christ.
Plowed it is. I mean, a freshly plowed field is definitely not flat. You see ridges. But if somebody would have walked through that field, you would have seen that, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be like a billiard, like very flat. But it has to be consistent. So even actually sometimes that's better, because if it's very blingy, so very shiny.
What? Sorry. Bling is like 7 years old.
Not in Europe, it isn't. So if it's very reflective, whatever, if you put a light on it to actually see some and have some magnification, then you're blind. And that's not useful in competition. Or anyhow. And other spacing is critical, because, I mean, if you're filing and you're filing a bit off, your valley will not be at the correct point. So it's key to consistently file and file neatly. It doesn't mean you have to be fast. You'll get fast later. Just open it at the first start, which is an awesome feeling. I just cut down a cylinder here, so any markings that do appear have to be dead smack in the middle of these circles. Otherwise, there's something wrong, because that's where the pins were going to be. So if I see a mark, and I'm not sure if that is that really a mark. Did I do that? Is that a wrong filing? Is that God knows what? If I put it in this jig thingy, if the mark is not dead smack in the middle of that circle, I know I can ignore it. So that's very useful. And, okay. So if you start off, it's quite handy to know where the markings will appear. Of course, this tool will help, but if you don't have that, on this you can't really see. That's a blanky, unmodified whatever. And what the American tool guys came up with is start off with a one cut file, with a one cut blank. So this is a factory cut, I reckon.
Yeah, we ran it through the Ultra Code. We just put the code.
It's actually technically it's a zero cut key, and you might say, well, that sounds stupid. It's clearly cut. What do you mean it's a zero cut? Well, the blank from the factory is actually slightly higher than zero, or which is no cut. So even telling an electronic code cutter this position should not be cut, as it moves across the key, it will still create, it'll remove a very slight bit of metal, just a fraction of an inch of metal off the top of the key, which is perfect for this use.
There you go.
Okay, so, and, well, magnification does help, of course, because sometimes they're very tiny. What also helps is good lighting. And so we're selling these. These are quite good. And, well...
Yeah, we're okay.
Yeah, we'll skip that.
We're okay.
Well, because you have to know how deep you file. What I normally teach is try to file consistent. If you see me filing... it's two strokes and I'm down one step. If you're eight strokes and you're down one step, that doesn't matter as long as it's always eight.
So right, because key depth cuts, they don't exist on an infinite continuum. Manufacturers have very specific cut depths for every possible position. What you're seeing is a sliding gauge. You'd lock the key into the gauge. You could see if you're on a position or not. What Jost did, he has this gorgeous caliper, the Kruplin, right? And the markings. Tell him about the markings.
Yeah, this Kruplin, these markings are for an Abusse 30 something. That's exactly the type of locks we use in European competitions. And so, if you look at my Kruplin now, it has a bunch more lines on it because Schlage should be on there as well because I do compete in American competition, or I get a new Kruplin. But lazy bastard, you know. So this helps a lot. And then you open it, and the end it looks like this. It looks maybe a bit funky because it's all round. We prefer to use round files, but it's a working key. It's perfect.
And at that point, it's not like picking where, I picked the lock and it's open once. If you impression a lock, even though it might take a little longer, you own that lock. You own that lock forever. And it's really amazingly powerful how you can use this attack. And we can talk about it all day, but then we're going to show you this really badass video, maybe even with sound, with the man over here looking
should
all
we,
baller.
Should we wait?
I think this is going to wrap it right here.
How do I start this?
It should start automatically.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Let me see.
Okay, you do that.
Click and... Huh? Oh, come on.
There you go. This is the final round, I believe, in German competition.
So the round just started. This video is not cut.
Yeah.
It's
they're
not
marking
sped
their,
up
yeah,
in
they're
any way.
They're spacing their keys. You used your gauge.
Yes.
Arthur used a stamp tool.
Yeah, he used a new tool that he had made, yeah.
So that's and you can see right up here.
This is the first time I touched the lock.
That's him right there. So you'll see that turn and wiggle right there in the middle.
Turn, wiggle. It's kind of fast.
He's not just scraping it. He's turn and wiggle. Super fast.
One depth. Normally these competitions, first round takes an hour and about half of the team opens. It's not that long of a video, I can assure you.
Open.
Wiggle, open.
57.
Now, I just want to say that the good people of Abus, which make quite good locks, you see us defeated in not split seconds, but under a minute.
How long does it take a locksmith to copy a key?
Yeah.
That's when you hand him the original key. I mean, this is with no information about the lock other than the brand.
And we're talking security pins here are irrelevant.
most of the time.
Right, the blue pins you saw, they're out of the plug until Abbas.
Yeah. Until Abbas, because Abbas, they've been supplying us with free locks and blank keys for quite a number of years, and we thank them for them. And, well, the positive side goes both ways, because now they come up with these evil pins.
Yeah.
This is a standard Abbas configuration. Yeah. This is not what we consider in Europe high security.
This is the European equivalent of a Schlage.
Nowadays. Yeah.
All right, so this is the equivalent of a commercial Schlage deadbolt.
They were like, for LockCon, they rubbed their hands, and they were like, oh, here's your locks. And if you could have heard the room within like 30 seconds this year, the first round, everyone's like, oh, so what the fuck is this? Like... Because the marks were going away, they were coming back, it was a mess.
Yeah, meanwhile, I was oblivious. I knew that there might be something coming soon from Abbas, but I thought these were normal locks, so I'm just sitting there trying to file normally.